Welcome to Close Up with Art Kaplan. I'm really privileged today to have a guest that I think you're going to find exciting, informative, and in some ways probably amazing in terms of the cutting-edge work that he is doing. Dr. Edward Rodriguez is at NYU. He recently came here from the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins. He is one of the world leaders in face transplantation, and I asked him to join us to talk today about some of the ethical, social, and medical issues involved with face transplant. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for the invitation, Dr. Kaplan.
So let's sort of jump to the medical part first. I think a lot of people are wondering, how do you get interested or make the move into a field like face transplant? What background brought you to this? Why did you decide to get into this particular cutting-edge area?
Well, I think there are a combination of events. Number one is education and training. I first began as a dentist and continued my training and education in oral and maxillofacial surgery. At that point, I continued to proceed into medical school.
So you were one of those MD,
DDS guys.
And
as I continued to pursue training to try to solve a clinical problem, I figured out that there were some issues that we really couldn't solve with conventional medicine or surgery. If we fast forward the clock a little bit, 2004, 2003, I begin as an adjunct faculty, begin my clinical work. At that time, we were also faced with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I was asked to assist in the treatment of soldiers at Walter Reed Medical Center and National Bethesda. And we were being faced with significant problems. At around that same time, I was also asked to participate in a research project, which is funded by the Office of Naval Research for Management of the Wounded Warrior. So putting all those elements together, it was only practical that the next logical step was to pursue facial transplantation as human subjects research for care of the wounded veteran.
You know, when I first heard about face transplantation being thought about, it was back in the early 2000s, I think. One of the things that concerned me from an ethics point of view was there didn't seem to be a lot of animal research on doing face transplants in rats, mice, primates, whatever. And I'm curious, do you use many of the same techniques that you learned in reconstructive surgery? Are they just being applied more fully to face transplant? Did the field sort of evolve with a good scientific foundation?
And that's a great question. The first transplant that occurred in 2005 by the group in Amiens and Lyon, there was no research. The only group that was performing animal research was the Cleveland Clinic group. That was a small animal model, rodent. And we decided to move forward with a larger animal, and we thought that it would be important to be able to translate that information to human subjects. And sure enough, we worked on the basic foundation of research for approximately 10 years before we went ahead with the clinical transplant. So that was pivotal. And we found some important things from a scientific standpoint that could be translated to human clinical trials. But of course, the technical components were modifications of advanced or conventional surgery.
Now, I don't want to alienate our more surgically oriented audience, although I know there are a lot of folks out there wondering about the obvious emotional, psychological issues, and we will come to those in a second, but I do want to give you and those interested in the technical side, what are the biggest challenges in doing face transplants? I mean, what are the most difficult things as opposed to trying to do a reconstruction of an injury to the face and so on? Are there difficulties in trying to get nerves to function again, trying to get the eyes to function? What's most challenging?
Right. Probably one of the biggest challenges, functional return, which is no one really knows. The first transplant was performed in 2005. To date, we're up to 30 transplants. So the difficult part is, number one, in the recipient, you have to remove all of the elements that have defined this person post-injury. So you actually have to recreate the defect. So that's a big challenge. You want to get to healthy, virgin tissue. Number two, the procurement of the facial allograft from the donor, you want to ensure that you're taking all the elements that will restore normalcy. Now, once you procure the face is preserved in a cold solution for about 3 hours. So we don't really know what's the determinant of longevity mm-hmm. in a solution, and is that going to work when you transplant the face? So the functional return has been a big issue. Are patients going to animate normally? Are they going to speak normal? So the return of function from a nerve standpoint is questionable. But what we've seen so far in about 30 patients, that has not yet to be a problem.
What brings patients to you? Do they say it's appearance, it's breathing, it's emotional signaling, it's social isolation? What do they say makes them think about even thinking about a face transplant?
It's a great question. It's a combination of factors. You would think that the obvious would be appearance, but for them, the most important is function. There's no question about it. Specifically with speech and eating, that's the biggest component. Now, without getting into specifics of vision or eyelids, the big problem is how can they socially interact?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when people look at them, there are a lot of curious individuals that want to ask questions. How did this happen? And they just try to avoid social contact. And that's what happens. They conceal themselves in their homes. They avoid social interaction. They, mm-hmm. they don't have employment. So it's a combination of functional. Obviously, they want to become social members of society. And the last component, an important one, is their appearance.
So let me ask this a slightly different way. When someone has been severely injured, do you think a face transplant as a kind of suicide prevention technique?
You would think that that's the case. And one of the part of a component of the patients that we see are patients that have self-inflicted wounds. And there's no question about that. When we look at the central facial injury, which is what we focused mm-hmm. on, because it was a similar type of injury that the wounded veterans were seeing as a result of IED blasts, we felt that that would be a good target of patients to try to reconstruct.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have to prove to us or confirm that they were psychologically stable. And there's a very rigorous psychological or psychiatric
assessment.
Evaluation and assessment before we move forward. But most of these patients, we would not consider individuals that are in a position right now with suicidal ideation.
I guess let me ask this slightly in a different way. When somebody suffers a horrendous facial injury beyond what reconstruction could really handle, are they more likely to want to end their lives? Put it another way, do you think face transplant is partly a technique of suicide prevention?
It's a great question. I hadn't thought about it that way before. I think when you have an individual, for example, a serviceman or a woman, that has an injury, I think that's facially disfiguring, those individuals are definitely more prone to
mm-hmm.
suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But the individuals that attempt some form of self-infliction of injury,
mm-hmm.
what we see is that those patients don't actually proceed to a suicide attempt secondarily, which is quite unusual.
Yeah.
And no one's really studied that.
Counterintuitive.
100%.
You know, the reason I asked you about the suicide prevention is one of the ethical issues that came up in the early days of face transplant, not that it's so old, but in thinking about whether it was ethical to try it, is they do have to take immunosuppression. We don't know how long the transplanted face is going to work. So some people said the risk-benefit ratio of putting people on immunosuppression, it's one thing to give them a heart or a liver and save their lives and deal with the risks of the drugs, but if you're kind of repairing appearance, is that worth it? You mentioned function is restored, but even maybe saving a life might be part of the rationale for taking that risk. How bad is the immunosuppressive challenge?
Well, it's same as solid organ patients. I think the quality of the medications have improved dramatically since the inception of solid organ transplantation. We're finding that the number of medications that they have to take are not as great as they used to. And when patients enroll in these trials, what we see is that the number of medications within the first 6 months are quite extensive.
Mm-hmm.
And then medications start tapering down. Because at the beginning, once you're immune suppressed, and we use a very strong lymphodepleting agent in the operating room, so mm-hmm. we have to support these patients from developing any kind of infections mm-hmm. or viral mm-hmm. infections, so we add a number of medications just for protection.
So you're always in that delicate balance, rejection versus infection.
Exactly, and that's a very tough balance at the beginning. But once we surpass those first 6 months, it could come down to anywhere from 1 to 3 medications a day. So it's not as demanding, but for sure you have to take that medication every day.
Well, let me jump into the donor side for a second. I think people are fascinated with this. When someone needs a face, I'll ask it literally, where do you turn? Where do you look for a potential donor? How do you identify someone and say, that might be a donor for us?
There are a couple of criteria that we look at, and we partner very closely with Organ Donor Network. In the state of New York, it's
Are the groups that get organs, kidneys, and livers anyway.
Correct. It's an organized system of organ procurement, and every state has them. And there's a universal governing body, which is labeled UNOS. So we partner together with our state institutions, organizations, and they help us define the types of patients. So there are specific things that we look for. We look for blood type match, obviously. Mm-hmm. We look for antibody match. But then we look at more specific things that relate to the face, like skin color match, skeletal morphometry.
Would you cross gender?
I would. And that's one of the interesting questions that we're looking at now. When we look at the pool of patients available for a specific match of a patient,
mm-hmm. that HLA and blood type.
It's very small.
Yeah.
And if we look at Richard's example.
Yeah, your patient, Richard Norris.
Our patient from Maryland, he had about a 14% chance of match looking at statistics of patients in the state of Maryland. And one of the ways that we thought of broadening that donor pool was to go to female donors. And sure enough, when we looked at female donors, we were able to increase the donor pool.
So let me stop there for a second. Man or woman, I wind up brain dead on life support. That's the place where I'm going to be a facial donor. Are you going to talk to my family? Is the organ procurement organization going to talk to my family? Do they care if I've signed a donor card?
Another great question. So surgeons are not allowed to communicate, and it's probably the right way to perform this mechanism. Surgeons do not communicate with a family in a time of great need. So the organ procurement organization is responsible for that communication, and they broker that relationship. There are specific occasions where the families do wish to talk to a surgeon. Mm-hmm. That's a limited instance. And with regards to consent of organs, what I feel is very important from our regulatory process is to separate facial donation from solid organ donation.
And is that due to the emotional significance? I mean, there are not a lot of poems written about people's pancreases, but face seems to have a
of course.
Different status.
And I think families should be aware in this tremendous time of need and difficulty that we would like to procure their face. And they should understand and be willing to make that informed decision.
So you almost set up an extra hurdle.
Exactly.
We want to hear that they're okay with this, even if they were okay with donating a kidney. When a face transplant happens, some donor families are going to want to be in contact with the recipient's family. Historically, we haven't really allowed that, various reasons, worries about too much intrusion emotionally, issues come up about are they going to try and get compensation under the table sometimes. Should they be in contact? Do they ask about being in contact?
That is a very common question, and rightfully so. If we know, we're looking at the scientific publications we've seen based on cadaver work, that the donor, there are some resemblances as they transplant that into the recipient patient, but there are some subtle resemblances.
Mm, mm.
You can't really say that you're going to see your loved one walking through the street. There's no question there are subtleties, nasal appearance, lips, depending on the tissues that are transplanted. But
do you think a family member could recognize that face?
I don't think so. But I would not want to argue with a loved one. And in our situation with our patient in Maryland, the mother who had an opportunity to meet the recipient did say that it looked like her son.
Interesting.
And I'm not going to get involved in that dilemma, but certainly there are some subtleties, especially if the recipient and donor did have resemblances pre-injury. There's no question about it. But that's a difficult question to ascertain. The donors sometimes do want to meet the recipient.
Mm-hmm.
The recipient sometimes do want to thank the donor. And how do we...
And historically, we've tried not to let, in the solid organ world, we try to preserve anonymity, partly for fear of intrusion into
Correct.
The person's life, partly for fear that some might even come and look for reward or payment or compensation down the road. In this area, with the face being so visible, it seems even harder to say we're going to be able to keep things anonymous, and particularly given all the publicity that currently surrounds it. They're going to see a face transplant on TV and kind of know
of course.
Who the recipient is, most likely.
And that's a great point that you bring up with the publicity and media coverage. I think it's appropriate that we notify the families mm-hmm. that this will be occurring. However, we cannot communicate directly through the families,
mm-hmm.
but the organ procurement organizations communicate with the donor families that this is
happening. So they're brokering again.
Yes.
So speaking of brokering, before I get into some of the recipient issues, what does this cost and how is it going to be paid for? To be blunt, do we have a good future here? I know it's expensive.
So if we look at the history of solid organ transplantation and we focus specifically on liver transplantation, which is somewhat of a similar dilemma where a large number of patients undergo liver transplantation for either self-created disease or an organic disease process. Face transplant is very similar. At the beginning of liver transplantation, a large number of those patients were not able to survive the operation. We fast-forward
dozens of deaths in the early days.
Exactly. And they felt, if we talked to the creators and the pioneers of that type, they did not feel that it was going to move forward. And sure enough, if we look at today's day and age, large numbers of liver transplants are being performed. Those
and
pioneers,
they're probably $250,000 and up. They're not cheap either.
Exactly. And if we can we compare price, when we looked at the budget at Maryland, and now that we're creating a business proposal here at NYU, what we've come up with a number is roughly $500,000. Now, that does not include the surgical procedure alone, since it is experimental.
Right.
It includes pre-screening, all the elements before the operation, the entire surgical procedure, use of hospital care, and also, since we're at the beginning of this new field, we're including essentially 3 months of hospital stay, just to be safe.
So one of the toughest issues is payment. How do you negotiate with payers, like the Department of Defense or insurance companies? What convinces them, what can you tell them that would make them say, this works, we're going to cover that?
And the Department of Defense has played a large role, and they've been incredibly generous in contributing to this innovative field. But their goal is to ultimately translate this into some form of standard of care and transition out from research. From our protocols, the way we've defined it, following 3 months of initial care, which is a good amount of care, we ensure that every patient that's enrolled in our regulatory process has some form of third-party support and that the third-party payer will contribute to the medical care
beyond.
So that's beyond
part of the access.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When thinking about access, let's move over to the recipients now. So, sadly, there are many different types of individuals who suffer horrendous facial injury, probably beyond anything that can be satisfactorily reconstructed, so to speak. How do you pick? How do you decide? You've got people who've tried to injure themselves. You've got accidents. I've seen people get transplants who are mauled by an animal. People who've been assaulted by a domestic partner.
Sure.
Children versus adults. How do you decide, well, who's going to get this?
It's a pretty interesting process. So initially, patients come to me or our surgical team with a deformity. We evaluate them, and we try to define at least an anatomical deformity that cannot be satisfactorily reconstructed. Once we feel that that patient has a deformity that cannot be reconstructed, then we proceed and we enlist them in the consent process. At that point, they get evaluated very closely by what we call a PSC, a participant selection committee, which is made up of psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, social workers, transplant surgeons, immunologists, so a whole slew of medical professionals and ancillary personnel that will be involved in deciding whether this individual is a good candidate. It has to be objective enough beyond my control.
Can I get in there if I'm a smoker?
We can evaluate you, of course, but one of the recommendations from our standpoint is that you have to cease smoking before you're enlisted in this protocol, and we do check with nicotine levels.
And how about that children versus adults? Does growth pose a challenge?
Growth is, and it's a great question, and now I think we're beginning to consider attempts at evaluating the child. It's a big process as it relates to informed consent, and I think someone like yourself can help us address that question more so.
The child's going to be going through quite a run, and I guess we could say, too, we don't know how long the transplant is going to last.
Correct. And now you put the informed consent process on the family. But you also got to look at the potential psychological dilemma of a child living with severe disfigurement until they reach an age that they can make an informed decision. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really touched that just yet.
Has anybody? I mean, is this something the field is talking about, going to kids?
The field is definitely talking about it. And I think there are specific children's centers, and NYU being one of them, because we've been dealing with craniofacial deformities for such a long time that it's
right, long history of dealing with that
of
at
course.
NYU. Yeah, yeah.
And families are beginning to talk to us about this. How does it work? How are the medications? What's the longevity? So it's something that at some point I think we will have to tackle. But for right now, we're being careful.
Whether it's a child or an adult, do you think that we are good at providing the kind of emotional follow-up to families of people who receive transplants? I mean, they clearly are going to be participants in this kind of current experiment or innovative surgery. Is that an area that you worry about?
Very much so. And I think more so in the face than you do in a solid organ. Because we're not just looking at function, but we're looking at psychosocial adaptation. We're looking at cultural integration. There are so many factors mm-hmm. involved.
And do you find different cultures being
of course
weary or less weary?
Very much yeah. so. And you see that within the family dynamics. Everyone's a little different how they look at this deformity. Now, one of the benefits here at our new location in New York is that we have a comprehensive center. And probably the biggest aspect, we all think that the surgical part, the technical part is challenging, but once we surpass that, everything else is psychosocial involvement,
fiscal,
assessment,
all that, yeah.
but 100%
yeah,
integration
yeah.
into society. And these patients are going to be ours for life to ensure that there are no major hurdles that they may encounter. And we just don't know when that will come about. But we're getting better. I think we're getting better at assessing that.
I think one of the things that I worry about the most with face transplants is, what if things go wrong? What if there's acute rejection? What if there is even worse, chronic rejection?
So what we've seen so far in the historical experience, all patients that undergo facial transplantation do have acute rejection episodes. Now, for lay persons, we can treat rejection. Mm-hmm. Rejection is treated with medication, and we supplement that. And that's not been a problem. Chronic rejection is a bigger problem. And to date, there's one patient with chronic rejection in the Amiens-Lyon group who is chronically rejecting the face. Now, the face does not completely fall off. It's sort of a slow resolution, loss of function, a scarring process, fibrosis. So it's not an immediate process, but what's interesting with that patient, he does not want to give up the face. And they're considering removing the face and relisting him, but he does not want to give up his face.
Is that technically possible?
Technically possible. So if that were to be considered, it would be the first patient that would undergo a procurement of a second face.
That's fascinating.
But that patient does not want to give up the face. So chronic rejection is a big problem, and we don't know how we're going to handle it. Probably the thing that keeps me up the most at night is that.
Is the chronic rejection.
What do we do if this presents itself? And now we have a patient that's been exposed to greater numbers of antibodies, making it more difficult to find a match. So every time we introduce foreign antibodies into a patient, we go reducing the potential match with another patient.
Well, let me thank you for this interview. And I have to say, I feel the procedure is in great hands, given your thoughtfulness and willingness to even put up with questions from the likes of me and others who worry about the ethical and social side. And I know you're really thoughtful in trying to pay attention to the entire spectrum of issues. I think that speaks well of where this might go. And again, thank you for being with me today. I'm Art Kaplan. Thanks for watching.